Our Bible study. If you were here last week, you'll know we've just begun a short series for this period that's often known as Lent, leading up to Easter, in which we're studying the closing chapters of John's Gospel. And today we look at chapters 18 and the first part of 19, which, remember, part of which was read earlier on. Let me remind you again how that section leading up to chapter 19, verse 16 concludes. Pilate brought Jesus out, verse 13, and sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as the stone pavement. It was the day of preparation of Passover week, about the sixth hour, that's what we would call noon. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, "Take him away, take him away, crucify him." "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered. It was, of course, a monstrous miscarriage of justice, wasn't it? Three men have spent 18 years in prison, convicted of murder on evidence which seems to have been fabricated by police officers. Trust, we all feel ashamed. Would that it were an isolated case. But coming on top of the wrongful convictions of the Guildford Four and the Birmingham Six, I guess many of us are beginning to wonder what is happening to our famous British judicial system. Our only comfort in regard to the Carl Bridgewater case, I guess, is that the jury did not deliberately ignore evidence that should have acquitted the three men in the dock. And the scandal has at least now been exposed and acknowledged by the courts, and some compensation, albeit woefully late and inadequate, can at least be offered to these men. But one inevitably wonders how many other innocents may be languishing undiscovered in our jails on similar trumped-up charges. Or what would have happened in this case if capital punishment had still been on the statute books? There are surely few things more necessary for the security of a civilized society than the confidence that an accused person will get a fair trial. If the state fails to offer that assurance to its citizens, it surely forfeits its claim to the legitimate exercise of power. And yet, sadly, we have to confess such miscarriages of justice are far from rare in our world. Indeed, in our Bible study tonight, we encounter what I reckon could be regarded as the most dreadful example of such a miscarriage of justice in the entire history of the world. 18 years ago, three men were incarcerated, convicted for a murder it seems they did not perform. Well, says John the Evangelist, 1,970 years ago, a man was tortured and executed, though he had been legally convicted of no crime at all. His name was Jesus. Even more interesting, perhaps, from our point of view, is this. Two systems of law inform our British judicial system and legislature more than any other, historically speaking. The law of Moses and the law of Rome. You ask any jurist, and he will tell you that the evidence of the influence of these two great ancient legal systems in our present-day British legal system is quite evident. Biblical law and Roman law. They not only underlie much of British legal system, but of every Western nation. Well, in the trial of Jesus, both the law of Moses and the law of Rome were invoked. And neither was able to defend this man. Neither resulted in his acquittal. Both these famous legal systems were in fact used to bring this innocent to the cross. Our task tonight is to try to understand how on earth that happened. To see what the Bible expects us to learn from the fact that it did happen. As I say, we have to help us in our inquiry the first-hand evidence of a witness named John. That he was a first-hand witness, I think, is quite obvious as you read his account. There are little touches again and again which indicate this is a man who was there at the scene. He spotted little things that even the other evangelists don't record. Even the temperature of the night. The outrage began, John tells us, when this man, Jesus, was arrested. It happened on the outskirts of Jerusalem by an armed police supported by a detachment of the military. And the first factor that contributed to that huge miscarriage of justice, John identifies as the treachery of one of Jesus' so-called friends. Look back to the very beginning of chapter 18. Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. That was quite a deep wadi near Jerusalem. On the other side, there was an olive grove, and he and his disciples went into it. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place, because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. They clearly expected Jesus would be hiding and would resist arrest, you see. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. And Judas, the traitor, was standing there with them. It's not difficult, is it, to detect the bitter edge to John's tone as he adds that final rather unnecessary parenthesis, "And Judas, the traitor, was standing there with them." Resentment still simmered in John's heart toward this man, Judas. Even years later, as he recalls his treachery. See, everybody knew the authorities would not dare to arrest Jesus in public. The reaction of the crowds to such a provocatively high-handed act, especially at Passover time, was far too unpredictable. But by exploiting his privileged knowledge of Jesus' private life, Judas was able to guide this posse of representatives from the Jewish establishment and the Roman authorities to a place where a clandestine arrest could be effected without any risk under cover of darkness. What was it, do you think, that motivated Judas to engage in such an act of disloyalty? I don't think it's a question we can answer with absolute certainty. Materialistic greed undoubtedly played some role. Remember, 30 pieces of silver had been the bribe. But was that all there was to it? I doubt it somehow. Dorothy Sayers, in her play The Man Born to be King, speculates that Judas was in fact a zealot sympathizer, a would-be revolutionary, who had become frustrated by Jesus' failure to seek the political overthrow of the Roman authorities. She suggests that the betrayal was an attempt by Judas to, as it were, force Jesus' hand in this regard, to leave him no choice but open confrontation with the powers that be. She suggests that Judas couldn't believe that Jesus would not, in such a position, employ his supernatural powers, which Judas knew Jesus had at his disposal. He would use those powers, Judas was sure, to ensure his vindication as the messianic king of Israel. But when Jesus refused to do that, refused to use his power in his own defense, and instead went unresistingly to the cross, Judas, according to Dorothy Sayers, was overcome with horror at the way his manipulative stratagem had backfired. And that's why he returned those 30 pieces of silver to the Jewish authorities and subsequently committed suicide. Well, it's a fascinating reconstruction, and it's not without its psychological plausibility, to my mind, but the Bible itself provides us little or no evidence to confirm such a theory. Our witness, John, tells us, back in chapter 13, verse 2, that it was Satan who prompted Judas's treachery. Indeed, in 13, verse 27, he goes even further and claims that Satan had personally entered this man in some unusual fashion. Language like that, the language of demonic possession in the New Testament, usually implies that the individual concerned has become so overwhelmed by some spiritual force of evil that they have been rendered, what we would say, insane. And if that's what John is implying by his description of Satan's penetration of Judas's heart and mind at this crucial moment, then maybe it's futile to seek a rational explanation of the man's behavior. Perhaps Judas himself didn't really understand why he did it, any more than perhaps Peter understood why. After so valiantly, if misguidedly, seeking to defend his master against arrest with the sword in chapter 18, verse 10, Peter is found in verse 17 cravenly denying all knowledge of Jesus. "Surely you are not another of this man's disciples?" the girl at the door asked Peter. He replied, "I am not." Fact is, you see, everybody let Jesus down that night. Even the noblest of his friends had forsaken him before that rigged trial was over. Judas was undoubtedly the most culpable, but he wasn't the only traitor to Jesus' cause. Indeed, it's worth asking whether there's one among us who can't remember letting Jesus down in some similar test. Haven't we all denied him? Haven't we all betrayed him? Like the moral cowards we are, haven't we all deserted him at the crucial moment? Abandoned him? We all know what it's like, don't we? Like Peter, to hear the cock crow and feel the rebuke of wounded love as Jesus' eyes meet ours. We let him down. The only difference between Judas and Peter was that Judas surrendered to self-pity, didn't he? He wasn't able to believe that the grace of God could pardon a crime as heinous as his, or restore a sinner as fallen as he was. So he despaired. Some want to argue that his suicide was an act of repentance, but that, of course, is the one thing suicide never can be. Suicide is the act of a person who has lost hope. It may be evidence of profound depression. It may be evidence of profound remorse. But it is never evidence of repentance. For repentance looks beyond the sin of the past to renewal, to restoration in the future. Repentance is a response of faith. Suicide is an act of despair. That's where, as I say, Peter was different. Mortified with shame, though Peter was that night, he clung on to faith. He survived the darkness of that Good Friday, and he found a new beginning on that first Easter Sunday. So in the darkness of that night, I suspect that day of hope must have seemed very distant. This is the first reason, then, for Jesus' miscarriage of justice. People let him down. His friends disappointed him. His friends even betrayed him. Maybe there's an incident in your life that recalls that same feeling of betrayal and disappointment. People you've trusted, people you thought were friends, who have let you down grievously. Well, be assured, Jesus understands exactly how you feel. Indeed, that was one of the reasons he went to the cross. Would there are only one Judas in the world? Truth is, there is a Judas in the heart of all of us. The treachery of a friend, then, that's the first contributory factor in this appalling miscarriage of justice. But there is another, and that is the corruption of the visible church. Look at the story continuing in verse 19 to 24 of chapter 18. The high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. "I have spoken openly to the world," Jesus replied. "I always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. So why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said." When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby struck him in the face. "Is that any way to answer the high priest?" he demanded. If I said something wrong, Jesus replied, testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? I guess we might have hoped that of all people, the religious leaders of Judea would have recognized the moral and the spiritual pedigree of Jesus. But sadly, all the Gospels witness to the fact that it was this Jewish hierarchy, this visible church of the Jewish community, that more than any other body sought his death. It was they who got him arrested. It was Annas and Caiaphas, the first century Jerusalem equivalent of the archbishops of Canterbury and York, who personally pressed charges against him in the Roman courts. Do you notice, incidentally, the hypocrisy in their behavior that John notes in 18, verse 28? They led Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, the Jews did not enter the palace. They wanted to be able to eat the Passover. Huge irony in that, of course. Here they were conspiring to put the Lamb of God, the true Passover, to death. And all they could think about was being ceremonially pure so they could enjoy the Passover party with their friends a bit later on in the day. In comparison, there is something very dignified, isn't there, about the way Jesus handles their interrogation of him. He knew, of course, as well as they did, that this was a kangaroo court and highly irregular. According to Jewish law, conviction had to be dependent on the evidence of independent witnesses. A man couldn't even condemn himself merely by his own confession. There had to be corroboratory evidence. Well, bring in the witnesses, Jesus says. You know perfectly well you can't convict me without witnesses. Where are they? My teaching has always been conducted in the public domain. People have heard me. They can testify to what I've said. Let them do so. But their response to this perfectly proper, even legal demand is to stoop to the bullying interrogation techniques of the Gestapo, isn't it? One of the officials nearby struck him in the face. And again, notice the dignity. Jesus is unabashed. I'm only asking for a fair trial, he says. Is that such a crime? We know from the other three Gospels that much more transpired in this interrogation with the high priests and with the Jewish council than John records here. False witnesses are indeed brought in. The entire Jewish council meets to discuss the case. In the end, Jesus is put under oath and forced to reply to a direct question, are you the Son of God? And in that situation, he replies in the affirmative. Yes, he says, it is as you say. And you will see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of the Almighty and coming in the clouds of heaven. Whereupon we're told that the Sanhedrin convicted him of blasphemy and condemned him to death. And that was when they took him to Pilate. But all this was going on during the night time, when according to the law, no such case could be heard. It was all very irregular. John, as I say, has left out much of that detail. Maybe he's decided he wants to just record those things which the other evangelists have not recorded. But the same essential picture is given to us here in John's Gospel, isn't it? A malicious prosecution without a shred of justification or proper legal process. It's quite clear they had made up their minds about Jesus long before his arrest. This is no trial. And they have no scruples about trying to give him a fair trial, even the pretense of a fair trial. See what they say in chapter 19, verse 7, when Pilate tells them to go and do their own dirty work? We have a law, they said, and according to that law he must die. Ironic and painful. For the law they're referring to, you see, is that law of Moses. The law of God. How inadequate that law now seems, wielded as it is by a corrupt church. But that is often the way it is, of course. Blinkered religious orthodoxy could find no space to give unprejudiced consideration to Jesus' claims. He said he was the Son of God. That's blasphemy. That's heresy. The law says death for such a crime. And no quality of mercy, no tinge of self-doubt could be allowed to interfere with the relentless execution of the capital sentence. It's always a dangerous thing, you know, when religious people think they have distilled out the absolute truth and that they are the human vehicles of that truth. And it is doubly dangerous when such self-appointed guardians of orthodoxy wield political power as well as spiritual influence in the community. Because in circumstances like that, heretics always get a raw deal. Oh, I'm not denying, of course, that heresy is dangerous. The church can never afford to allow false ideas to go unchallenged, or the very nature of truth is blurred in people's minds. But the only safe way to oppose such theological error is by refuting it, never by repressing it. The reason for that is quite simple. Until you've examined a heretic's ideas very carefully, you see, you can never be sure whether he is a true heretic or a prophet in disguise. Both heretics and prophets, you see, are subversives. Both of them threaten the status quo by their radical ideas. But if you make a habit of executing the former, you are likely to find yourself crucifying the latter as well. And the trouble is, when the reins of power in the hands of those who have a vested interest in the maintenance of the theological status quo, it is all too tempting to take the shortcut of repression rather than engage in the much more demanding and possibly unsettling task of theological refutation. This, of course, was what was responsible for the great disaster of religious repression that took place in the 16th and 17th century. Roman Catholicism, for a start, believed it had the truth. Any contradiction of its dogma had to be, by definition, heresy. And since in many European countries, Catholicism also had access to the power of the sword, it was not difficult to eliminate those who questioned her doctrine. Thus, orthodoxy became bigotry, and bigotry became intolerance, and intolerance became the Inquisition. Would that I could tell you that Protestantism, in its rebellion against that Catholic dogma, learned the danger of such repressive tactics, but I fear it didn't. The poor Anabaptists, you know, were persecuted just as mercilessly by the Calvinists and the Lutherans as they were by the papacy, and for the same reason. When the state joins hands with the church, heresy becomes treason, and free inquiry becomes a capital crime. It's worth asking whether we are free from such repressive and intolerant attitudes in the church today. Sometimes I fear, you know, that those of us who like to style ourselves reformed, as many of us I know in this church, are, in fact, the most incapable of reformation in the entire church. No one is more like 16th century Catholicism than those who call themselves reformed. They are sure they're right. Their systematic analysis of correct doctrine is the divine truth, and any contradiction of their system is a blasphemous attack on God himself. The Bible says there are no prophets for such inflexible Christian minds, only heretics. And so, constrained by our intellectual funnel vision, we conduct our witch hunts, don't we? As blindly and as mercilessly today as did the Spanish Inquisition 300 years ago. In fact, you know, I believe some of us are so blinkered in our thought processes, so blindly intolerant of anybody who differs from our point of view, so utterly convinced of our own infallibility, that if we had access to the power of the sword, we would be executing people. Maybe we would have even crucified Jesus. What do you think? That's the second thing, anyway, that contributed to his wrongful arrest and execution. The treachery of a friend, the corruption of the visible church. But there was a third factor, wasn't there? And in fact, it's the factor which John seems to give more attention to than any other. The weakness of the courts. Look how he continues the story in verse 28 of chapter 18. Then the Jews led Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, the Jews didn't enter the palace, they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. So Pilate came out to them and asked, "What charges are you bringing against this man?" "If he were not a criminal," they replied, "we would not have handed him over to you." Pilate said, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." I don't know what you think. It sounds to me, rather, as if the Jewish authorities were a little surprised by Pilate's uncooperative attitude at this point. The suspicion is raised in my mind, you know, that they had already prepared the way for this hearing. After all, Roman soldiers had assisted at Jesus' arrest. Those soldiers could not have acted without Pilate's say-so. And Pilate doesn't seem to raise any voice of protest or surprise about this request for a legal hearing at this very early hour in the morning. It all sounds to me as if they had arranged it long before. No doubt they told Pilate that there was this guy called Jesus who claimed to be the king of the Jews and was clearly a political subversive, and they needed some help getting him arrested and tried. Yet you see, when Pilate is actually confronted by this purported revolutionary leader from Galilee, we find him suddenly reluctant to go on colluding with the Jews in their conspiracy to have him summarily executed. Why does he try to put the buck back onto them? "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." Why does he try that? I don't know, perhaps his soldiers had brought him a report of the circumstances of the arrest. I can imagine the centurion coming to him and saying, "Oh, the troops were really quite unnecessary, Your Honor. He didn't behave like a criminal, still less like some dangerous subversive plotting revolution. He came out publicly and offered himself. There was very little resistance. In fact, the only violence that was shown, he himself stopped. Our men found something rather awesome about him, actually, sir. They were quite taken aback by his manner. In fact, sir, to be honest, if he hadn't come willingly, I'm not sure they would have been willing to lay hands on him." Could it be that Pilate had some report like that from his officer ringing in his ears? One thing we do know from Matthew's gospel is that Pilate's wife had a bad dream about Jesus. The precise circumstances of that are a total mystery. But it is quite clear that Pilate's wife had a word with her husband before he went to meet Jesus and told him she didn't like the sound of this man. She'd had a bad dream about him. There was something magical, something supernatural about him. "Don't have anything to do with him," she told Pilate. The Romans were notoriously superstitious, you know. That could have weighed in his mind quite a bit. Or I suppose it could just have been a reflection of his antipathy towards the Sanhedrin, towards the Jewish hierarchy. I mean, we know that Pilate detested the chief priests and all they stood for. I guess he was quite shrewd enough to realize that they were the very last people to bring a genuine anti-Roman agitator to him. Now, these trumped-up charges of subversion and rebellion were clearly just a cover for the real things they had against this man. And they were bound to be something to do with their horrible little religion. That would have been Pilate's attitude. Frankly, if Jesus was an enemy of the Jewish council, he had Pilate's fullest sympathies. So if he was moved to be uncooperative with the Jews, perhaps it was no more than that. He wanted to snub these obstreperous and pompous Jews. Whatever the motive for his initial lack of cooperation was, it's clear too, isn't it, though, that it was reinforced by his own interrogation of Jesus. John recalls this in some detail. It seems he must have had some inside information from the palace to tell us the sorts of things that went on. It was a most remarkable conversation, wasn't it? Just look at how it continues in verses 33 and following. Pilate went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Is that your own idea?" Jesus asked. "Or did others talk to you about me?" See, he's shrewd. He knows he's been set up. "Do you think I'm a Jew?" Pilate replies. "It was your people and your chief priests who handed you over to me. What is it you've done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is from another place." "You are a king then," says Pilate. Jesus answered, "You are right in saying I am a king. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." "What is truth?" Pilate asked. How are we to interpret that cryptic parting question? What is truth? Is it the dismissive contempt of a skeptic? Is it the ironic jest of a cynic? Or could it be the disappointed wistfulness of a man who wishes he could find something to believe in, but has long since given up the hope? Whatever it meant, it is obviously quite clear to Pilate that the man who stands before him is more of a Socrates speaking the language of philosophy than a Judas Maccabeus who is plotting revolution against the state. Pilate had seen many subversives, many revolutionaries in his day. This man, Jesus, did not have the bearing of one of them. He quite clearly had never wielded a sword in his life. 3 times Pilate announces his verdict. "Not guilty." 18 verse 38 is the first time. "He went out to the Jews. I find no basis for a charge against him." 19 verse 4. "Once more Pilate came out and said to the Jews, 'Look, I'm bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him.'" 19 verse 6. "Pilate answered, 'You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him.'" 3 times. But of course, for any judge worth his salt, that is 2 times too many, isn't it? You don't have to declare a person not guilty 3 times. Once will do. All he had to do, if that's what he really thought, was to dismiss the case. But that was Pilate's problem. He was a weak man. We find him, in fact, in these two chapters, hopping backwards and forwards in a slightly clownish way. First talking to the Jews outside and then talking a bit more to Jesus in private. He behaves, in other words, more like a negotiator seeking some kind of political compromise than behaving like a judge who seeks to administer justice. He tries every way he can to get out of the situation. First passing the baton onto the Jews and telling them to go and do their own dirty work, which they refuse to do. Then in 18 verse 38, he offers an amnesty to the prisoner. "It's my custom to release you one prisoner at Passover time. Do you want me to release the king of the Jews?" But again, he gets nowhere with that. They prefer Barabbas, a known criminal, to this innocuous-looking Galilean. So Pilate tries a third device to get himself out from under this problem. He has Jesus flogged and humiliated by his troops in 19 verse 1. It's not difficult, is it, to picture the scene that John is describing at the beginning of chapter 19. "Oh, this guy's supposed to be the Jewish Messiah, you know. Well, let's dress him up. Let's put him in a purple robe, just like Caesar wears. And let's make a crown for him, since he's a king. We'll make him a crown of thorns. And let's put a scepter in his hand. And beat him over the head with it a bit. "Hail, Caesar," they said, mockingly. Even if Jesus had been a convicted criminal, this kind of crude horseplay would have been unfair and vicious. But Pilate has already declared him innocent. Why does he turn a blind eye to the flogging and to the humiliation? But it's all a device, you see. In verse 4, we begin to get a glimpse of what his idea is. He brings Jesus out with the marks of the beating and the humiliation and the crown of thorns still on his head. "Look at this pathetic individual," he says to the Jews. "Is this the man I'm supposed to crucify as an enemy of the state? Is this the man you're so concerned about? Look at him. Behold the man." But no glimmer of pity softens the eyes of those Jewish leaders. As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify! Crucify!" "You take him and crucify him," says Pilate, returning to his original ploy. "I find no basis for a charge against him." The Jews answered, "We have a law, and according to that law he must die, because he claimed to be the Son of God." At last they have let slip the real issue for them. Not that he claimed to be the King of the Jews, but that he claimed to be the Son of God. All Pilate's superstitious fears suddenly resurfaced. "What did you say? He claims to be the Son of God?" When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid. He goes back inside the palace. "Where do you come from?" he asked. He's scared of this man, you see. The testimony of his centurion, the testimony of his wife, now his own experience of the dignity and majesty of this man standing before him in private audience. It's all conspired to make Pilate very uncomfortable about signing the death warrant of a man who claims to be the Son of God. He goes back to talk to him again. And Jesus is remarkably kind to him, isn't he? "You would have no power over me," he says in verse 11. "If it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin." It's a noble and a rather generous statement, but it's tantalizingly ambiguous, isn't it? Superficially, that verse 11 could simply mean all authority, all civil authority, reflects divine authority. God stands behind the powers that be. He it is that has appointed civil authority to execute justice in the world. That's the Bible's view of the legitimacy of the state. It's the point that Paul argues in his great letter to the Romans, chapter 13. Jesus could be saying something as simple as that. "Your authority, Pilate, is one delegated to you from God." "You're only doing your job then, Pilate. I sympathize with the political complexity of the situation you're trying to handle. The real villains in all this are those who are trying to manipulate the system to silence me. That's the reason, you know, they brought me to you. The reason they don't want to conduct the execution is all that they can do is to have me stoned. But stoning would be a public act and require the consent of the multitude. You, on the other hand, you will crucify me. There's nothing the crowd can do about that. What's more, someone who hangs on a cross is regarded as cursed by the Jews. It's the only way they can think of getting rid not just of me, but of the threat I pose to them, to have me crucified. That's the death appointed for me, Pilate. It has to be you who signs the death warrant. But those who conspire for it, they are guilty of a greater sin than you are. The real contest here, Pilate, is not between me and Roman law. It's between me and my people. the Jewish people, the people of God. So I say that could be what Jesus is saying. But I think there's an additional dimension to what he's saying here. And there's a subtlety, actually, in the Greek text, which I appreciate you won't pick up in translation, but it rather confirms me in my view. See, that word it, you would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. In the Greek version of this, in the Greek original of this, that word it does not agree with the word power, which is a feminine word. That word it is neuter. It's a small point. But it suggests, you see, that what Jesus is really saying here is, you would have no power over me if this situation had not been given to you from above. I think that's what Jesus is actually getting at. More than a general statement about the divine origin of civil power, I think what Jesus is saying here is, this whole situation, my being on trial before you, Pilate, it has been engineered by a divine providence. There is a divine purpose in all of this, which you cannot possibly thwart. You would have no power at all over me if this whole situation had not been generated by the sovereign purpose of God. On hearing that, John tells us, Pilate was all the more determined to try to see Jesus set free. But the Jews had one last trump card to play. Do you see them play it in verse 12? If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar. Now, I say this was a really crafty move. It may very well be that the date of all this, around the beginning of 31-32 AD, coincided with a very difficult time politically for Pontius Pilate. We know from other sources that Tiberius, the Roman emperor, had recently executed at that time a great friend and patron of Pontius Pilate, a man called Sejanus. Pilate's position as governor in such circumstances might well have been rather insecure. Certainly any kind of Jewish unrest was likely to prove very embarrassing for him. It was not likely to improve his reputation in Rome or the length of his contract in Jerusalem. I suspect you know that Pilate was not sufficiently strong politically at this point to risk a major Jewish insurrection, or even the thought that he had taken the possibility of such an insurrection lightly. So much as he would have liked to have thwarted the Sanhedrin, the Jews, he seems to have accepted that they had politically outmaneuvered him on this occasion. Jesus would have to go. The diplomatic price of a quiet life for Pilate, and possibly of his continued career prospects in politics. When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out, sat down on the judge's seat. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews. Take him away, crucify him. "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asks. "We have no king but Caesar," they reply. So finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. There's a word, of course, for Pilate's weakness here, isn't there? Pragmatism. Pragmatism says, don't worry too much about right and wrong. Do what works. The end justifies the means. Do what is expedient. Pragmatism, of course, has been the creed of most modern politicians. Jesus wasn't the first, nor by a very long chalk will he be the last innocent man to be sacrificed on the altar of somebody's career, or to be eliminated in the so-called interests of national security. The fact is, of course, that the one thing, according to the Bible, that God puts civil government on earth to defend above everything else is justice. But that thought never seriously enters Pilate's head. He's worried about himself. He's worried that this man Jesus might put a magic curse on him or something of that sort. He's worried about what the consequences of this trial might be for his position in Jerusalem or with the emperor. The last thing that enters his head is justice. He knows there's no basis for any capital charge against Jesus. He candidly admits it 3 times. But no amount of water can wash away then the blood that stains the hands of this man who still knowingly signed the death warrant. He was, as I say, weak. John F. Kennedy, in one of his speeches, comments on the fact that Dante, in his great poem The Inferno, locates Pilate in one of the deepest parts of hell. Kennedy observes, "The hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a moment of great moral crisis, try to maintain their neutrality." Could it be that some of us would have done just the same? It's not just Pilate, is it, who acts expediently, pragmatically, in situations of moral crisis? Aren't we all sometimes afraid of what the consequences will be? Afraid of what people will say? Afraid of what our colleagues will think of us? Isn't that the reason some of you aren't Christians? You know deep down the ring of truth that you hear when you read this gospel account and you face this man Jesus. You feel like Pilate did. The force of the majesty of this man, his moral superiority, his divine presence. But rather than face up to it or act upon that intuition that burns at the back of your mind, you act pragmatically. What's this going to mean for my life? How's it going to affect my friendships? What will my boyfriend, what will my girlfriend think about it? What will my parents think about it? Will it change my career? Pragmatism, you see, isn't just the creed of politicians. It's the hallmark of all moral cowards. And moral cowards is what most of us are. Now, there were more than a few of those surrounding the cross that first Good Friday who were there because they did not have the courage to stand at Jesus' side. Pilate was just one among many who knew he was innocent, but was not prepared to properly say so. Here it is then. This is the reason for this great miscarriage of justice. The treachery of a friend, the corruption in the visible church, the weakness of the courts. Nothing new about it, is it? It's the sort of thing we're familiar with. The sort of thing that has happened down through history, the sort of thing that still happens today. The treachery of friends, the corruption of the church, the weakness of the courts. Those who should have stood by him, those who should have recognized him, those who should have defended him. They all failed. But then that's what we human beings are. Failures. The Bible, of course, has one single word to describe that global failure. It calls it sin. It's sin which led to Jesus' false arrest and execution. The sin that puts self-preservation and vested interest above issues of truth and justice. In fact, I think nowhere is the essence of that sinfulness more damnably evident than in that appalling final exchange that we read in verses 13 to 16. See what Pilate says to them? "Here is your king," he says. Take him away and crucify him," they shout. "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asks. "We have no king but Caesar," they answer. You have to understand the situation of first century Judea to understand what an appalling indictment of the integrity of these chief priests that statement is. "We have no king but Caesar." Who were they trying to kid? It's an appalling irony, this confession of loyalty to the Roman Empire, because it was totally insincere. The Jews detested Caesar and all he stood for. And yet, you see, what a terrifying admission this statement is of their own spiritual bondage. Here are human beings who are prepared to submit themselves to any dictatorship, no matter how brutal, no matter how demonic it may be, rather than confess the sovereign claim of Jesus over their lives. we have no king but Caesar. To their shame, they would rather pledge allegiance to a pagan emperor than to God's Messiah. No, people are like that. That is the nature of our sin. It is fundamentally a rebellion against God. That's the root of it. We were made by God to be ruled by Him. But in our pride, we have usurped that throne. We have declared unilateral independence from God. We want self-government. That's the root of all our sin. That's what leads to our treachery. That's what leads to our corruption. That's what leads to our moral weakness. That's the root of our injustice and our failure to live by the truth. Rather than face up to God's sovereign claim over our lives, we would rather put ourselves in bondage to anyone, even a Caesar. I suppose many of us, coming from the modern Western world, would like to think that we are above all this. We have democracy. Democracy, we are sure, is a surefire protection against this kind of miscarriage of justice. Don't you see it? Democracy, more than any other system, is an affirmation of our right to rule ourselves. We're not meant to be a democracy. Our democracy may be the best way to rule a nation. But we are not to think of ourselves as people who have the right of self-determination. We're designed to function in submission to the royal direction of God. King Jesus, he came to earth to reassert that sovereign authority of God over our lives when we had disdained it. And that is why we put him on the cross. Oh, I know all sorts of people colluded in this miscarriage of justice. There was Judas, and there was Caiaphas and Annas, there was the Sanhedrin, there was Pilate. They were all guilty. But I tell you, it was not their sin, ultimately, that nailed him to that cross. It was ours. Well, let me ask you, where would you have been that first Good Friday? Where would you have been? Some of us would have been with Judas, calling ourselves his friends, but when the heat got turned up, abandoning him, even betraying him. Some of us would have been with Caiaphas and Annas, so proud of our reformed theology, we couldn't recognize the Son of God when he met us. And some of us would have been with Pilate, ambitious, self-seeking, pragmatic, willing to send anybody down if it means we survive. What matters to God, you see, is not that our hands were not the actual hands that drove those nails through Jesus'. What matters to God is that our hearts are wicked enough to have done it. And they are. And the democracy that we like to parade as our great answer to Roman imperialism, the modern way to run a country, would not have stopped us. Miscarriages of justice are happening in our courts today for the same kinds of reasons. Weakness and corruption and treachery. It's not a question of how you run your country. It's a question of how you relate to the God who made you. Our problem is our moral rebellion against his righteous rule. Our problem is that we put ourselves first. And so long as the world is full of people like us who put themselves first, people like Jesus will end up on a cross. Don't you see what John the Evangelist is trying to help us to see in the way he tells the story? He's inviting us to embrace a new way of thinking about ourselves and our world. Jesus is your legitimate sovereign, he said. There's irony in the way Pilate presents him to the Jews. Shall I crucify your king? Behold your king. John wants us to see in that Yes, indeed, he is. That's who he really is. Oh, of course, his style of kingship is very different from the kind of authoritarian dictatorship which monarchy so often has proven to be in political history. By his own testimony in chapter 18, it is not a kingdom of this world. It's not a kingdom where his law is enforced by coercion, by violence. My servants would not fight. No. His rule is enforced by a voluntary obedience, an obedience constrained by those whose hearts are fixed on heavenly rather than material values, who wield no weapons except the weapons of prayer and righteousness. Yet John would have us know that this kingdom of Jesus, this kingdom which is not of this world, is an invincible kingdom. You would have no power over me at all, he tells Pilate, if it were not given you from above. Behind the machinations of political leaders, a sovereign God administered Jesus' domain with a sureness of touch and a certainty of purpose which is never thwarted, never surprised. That's the kingdom John is inviting us to join. Here is your king, he says. He invites us to share in the day of his enthronement. Yes, this king reigns from a cross. He oppresses no one. He bullies no one. He tortures no one. The appeal of this king is addressed to free men and women the world over. Renounce the folly of your independence, he says. It is illegitimate. It is futile. Here is your king. He reigns from the cross. Join those unnumbered millions then, who now today own his sway.